Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show online at edexcellence.net. Now please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, a man who's been taking his wife to foodie restaurants in Lower Manhattan for years, Andy Smerick.
Hey, what up, Mike? Thanks for having me.
Andy, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
You've become something of a regular.
Well, twice in the span of a couple years, I guess that's regular.
Yeah, twice.
It's an honor and pleasure to serve.
Well, and you finished so strong last time that we decided to bring you back.
Yes, I'm going to not botch it like I did last time.
You didn't botch it. Well, you know, Rick is off doing one of his many projects. He's a busy, busy man. Do you know that?
He is a...
He's down in Houston. As I always say, June in Houston. Can't beat that.
No. He'll probably have another book written by the time he gets back.
That is probably true. On the plane. Yeah. Okay, well, we got a lot to cover today.
Yep.
We're, of course, going to play a part in the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute, a special handwritten Research Minute today. And then we're going to have Stafford rate that reform. So shall we get started?
Let's do it.
Now, Christina is off in China. This is how well-traveled the Education Gadfly Show team is. She's off in China.
Very cosmopolitan your team is.
She's in China. So Alex, the intern, is filling in. So Alex, the intern, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Don't botch it.
Test scores in New York State are up across the board. Klein and company are celebrating success, while others are expressing skepticism. What's the fairest way to view this development?
So I am big in favor of it. I think that it's a big advancement.
Big in favor of test scores going up?
I'm big in favor of saying that the New York test scores are legitimate. There's this group of hyper-skeptics who believe that, who've been looking underneath of every rock and stone to show that these test scores aren't valid for one reason or another. And so lo and behold, they got this analysis, and I put analysis in air quotes for those listening, that came out within the past couple days that claimed to show that the New York State assessment is only testing kids on a subset of the information that they really ought to know on the state standards. Now, this was an analysis, wasn't peer-reviewed, it wasn't in a journal, it hasn't been replicated, it was done by a blogger who's a graduate student. And so all these hyper-skeptics who pat themselves on the back for casting a critical eye on data, all of a sudden are treating this two-day analysis like it's holy scripture.
Yeah, because we on the education reform side never do this, publishing our findings on the pages of the Wall Street Journal first, for
example. I think that sort of the point of this is that if we're going to be skeptical of what New York State has put out, we should be skeptical of what this blogger has put out, whether or not this analysis is true. But the second point is her whole contention is that the assessment is only assessing kids on a certain amount of information. And then she leaps to this conclusion, well, therefore kids don't know anything else. And I just think that's unfair.
What she's saying here is that the test is becoming more predictable and that teachers, they see the test in full after the fact. And if they see year after year the same sort of subject matter being covered and the same kinds of questions, the same kind of prompts, well, it's not that hard to figure out that if you want to do better on the test, you teach your kids that subject matter and you teach them using those kinds of prompts. And we've seen this in other places. Linda Perlstein's book, Tested, that took place in your hometown of Annapolis, talked about, Maryland has these certain kinds of writing prompts that they use every year. And so teachers start to just have kids write in that style over and over and over again. And what it means is that their test scores go up, it doesn't actually mean they're learning more.
I would have to say that that's a conjecture. That's an assumption. We do not yet have data showing that that's true.
But what we do have from the proficiency illusion, from NAEP, what we see is a consistent pattern. State test scores going through the roof, and then we see on NAEP or on other kinds of exams, we see, if anything, some very modest gains. And so what that seems to imply is that kids are getting better at taking the state tests, but they're not actually getting better at knowing the broad domains that are being tested.
Or it means that the teachers are actually teaching state content standards, what they're supposed to teach, not NAEP standards, which they're not supposed to teach.
Except in our study, our test was linked to the content standards. All right, we're out of time for that one. Alex, topic number two.
New results from New York City's Learn and Earn program show that the kids who participated in the experimental program, whereby they earned cash for boosting their grades, attendance, and test scores, outperformed other kids on the state test. Does this mean the program works?
No, it does not mean the program works. Look, we've had a lot of discussion on the show and in the Education Gadfly about whether or not these programs are worth doing anyway, whether they're ethical. And my own view has been, I'm open to seeing some experimentation. But let's get this straight, Andy. So the kids know that they're going to get more money if they score better on this particular test that they're sitting down to take. Well, of course those kids are going to just take the test more seriously and try harder than kids who don't have that incentive. So of course their test scores are going to be higher on average. That doesn't, again, mean they're actually learning more math or reading. It just means they're trying harder on the test.
Well, does that suggest that we should pay all students to for all tests?
I mean, no, it just implies that the experiment isn't such a great experiment. That if you want to know, is this program working to have kids actually be learning more material, then you've got to use an independent test that's not tied to the stakes in the program. I'm sure there's some researcher word for this.
No, it seems to me that if what it's trying to test is whether or not the motivation of getting money will lead to higher test scores, and it seems like the motivation of getting more money is leading to higher test scores. Whether or not that means it's higher learning, we don't know.
Andy, someday I'm going to teach you to be more skeptical.
I know.
Okay, very similar topic as last, and we're going to zoom ahead to topic number three.
The Chicago Public Schools awarded a high school diploma this week to Eleanor Benz, a 90-year-old woman who dropped out of school as a senior during the Great Depression in order to help earn money for her family. This was before Learn and Earn, mind you, and later birthed 15 children.
15!
Yet she didn't actually have to go back and do the work she missed in 1936. Is this another example of the soft bigotry of low expectations?
Absolutely, Alex. Yes, it is. All right, now look, I know this is a cute story about an old granny. She's got like a bazillion grandkids. She finally gets her diploma. All right, but we've seen these stories before, and usually the story is the 90-year-old granny goes back, takes the course that she missed, does the one more thing she had to do, and gets the diploma. It's not they just give it to her because they feel good about it. I mean, what is this, Andy? This is nothing but low expectations. Why can't she go back and do the work she missed back in 1936?
Are you really beating up on a 90-year-old woman with 15 kids?
No,
but let me make sure I got this right.
I am beating up on the Chicago Public Schools.
I'm speechless. What I'm actually interested in is, say she only got 11 and a half years worth of education. I bet her 11 and a half years of education back in 1936 is equivalent or even superior to the graduation requirements for students in 2008 or 2009. But that's a testable hypothesis, probably. I'm looking at Amber. Maybe we could check that out. But no, conservatives always like wears a badge of honor beating up on good news stories, and I'm not going to take that bait. I'm all in favor of Miss Betts and her graduation and whatever else.
Now see, if Illinois had a high school graduation test, which I don't think they do, then we could have her sit for the test. If she passes the test, I am fine giving her a diploma.
I would love to watch you try that.
And by the way, I think that this is a form of ageism to say, oh, she's 90. And so what? She's 90. You know what? In this country, there's a lot of people who are 90. People are living longer. I mean, I think that people can do lots of things when they're 90, including go back and take a high school class. And to not say that, I think, is just another form of bigotry to say, oh, those old people, they can't learn anything new. They can't teach an old dog new tricks. I think that's despicable, Andy.
You're mad.
All right, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Intern Alex, nicely done. Thank you for joining us. It is now time for everybody's favorite portion of the show, Amber's Research Minute.
Hey, Amber.
Hey.
Now, this is the point where Rick would probably say something inappropriate, right? When Amber comes on.
Generally.
So I don't have to do that, do I?
You do not have to.
We'll take
a
pass on that this week. Thanks.
My pleasure.
All right, Amber. What are we talking about this week?
All right. Well, we've long thought that teacher evaluations are a joke. But last week, the new Teacher Project issued the most systematic study to date called the Widget Effect that demonstrates they are just that. They examined teacher evaluations in 4 states and 12 districts of various sizes. The findings are frankly worse than what we may have thought. First, 99% of tenured teachers receive satisfactory ratings when the other choice is unsatisfactory. And even when the rating scale has more than 2 options, principals in all districts rated the majority of teachers in the top category. Even in schools that didn't make AYP, most teachers received the highest rating. In Cincinnati, for instance, whose teacher evaluation system, by the way, has been praised nationally, less than 10% of failing schools rated a tenure teacher unsatisfactory. The picture is no better for novices. In many districts, the number of novices not renewed for employment was less than 1% annually. Finally, in all 12 districts, areas for improvement, quote unquote, were identified for only a quarter of teachers during their most recent evaluation, which reveals evaluations are largely red stamp processes. The report ends with a number of recommendations, one of which is not only to use evaluations for the very rare dismissal, but also for compensation, professional development, and granting tenure.
Whew, nicely done. All in a minute.
Whew, I did that on the Metro. I do better when I write it on the Metro for some reason.
Yeah,
it's weird.
Yeah.
Interesting findings.
So, a couple questions here. So, all right. to me, that the major finding that these teacher evaluation systems are a joke isn't too surprising.
That's right.
Because if you're a principal and you can't actually do anything with this information, I mean, if you, you know, if you rate a tenured teacher poorly, but you still can't fire him or her, then all you're really doing is making life difficult for yourself. And now that teacher is mad at you and, you know, might sue you. I mean, this is from personal experience at the U.S. Department of Education, where people basically have lifelong tenure if you're in the career civil service. And so, you know, managers just give great evaluations because why, you know, why go through the hassle of giving somebody a low evaluation? You probably will get sued because people do that all the time, where they file complaints saying you were unfair to give them a 2 instead of a 3.
And as a person who used to be a university supervisor of student teachers, I had probably 3. One year I had 40 of them, and 3 of them were just terrible, and I gave them very low evaluations. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, basically the director was like, what are we going to do? Not graduate them? They're going to have to repay their tuition? You know, what are you going to make them go through the program another year? I mean, yeah, you're kind of stuck.
So, but that hypothesis doesn't work for the non-tenured teachers. I mean, so how can we explain why?
Right.
Why is it that principals are so unwilling to be tough on their new teachers and weed out the ones that aren't doing a very good job?
Does it suggest something about the culture of education? People have pointed this before, that maybe it just recruits and trains and keeps people who are not interested in conflict, not interested in making tough decisions.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael Barone, who I happen to just see, talks about hard America and soft America, and that there's, you know, these professions that are in soft America that are all about being nice and not being tough on people. But still, I don't know. I wonder. I mean, or it could be that principals think that, hey, they got, these are the best they're going to get. Their HR systems are so broken, or, you know, they see that, you know, in terms of the people that they see every year, maybe they think, this teacher's mediocre. But I'm not going to get any better in the next crop of new recruits.
Or do they? Right. Are they just unable to distinguish between great teachers, mediocre teachers, bad teachers? Do the principals not have the ability to know
training.
Who the good ones are?
So, Amber, the recommendations, I mean, do you feel like they were linked to the findings very well?
I felt like they were, clearly it's an advocacy piece of work. I mean, the methods were just really not explained well at all, but... yeah, I mean, I think it was not surprising. Of course, we want the evaluations to have teeth. We want them to mean something. You know, we want them linked to professional development, compensation, tenure decisions. I mean, but, you know, that's a whole culture shift. I mean, you just can't just say that and then presto, we make them have teeth, you know.
So you agree that teachers should not be widgets?
I do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Another bold statement. All right, Amber, so what is the song that goes along with this widget study?
Since we think teacher evaluations are mostly a sham, we have Living a Lie by The Dream featuring Rihanna.
Andy, you are required to
dance during the songs, Andy.
I'm wondering how you find
get
the songs.
Get it right. Laura's my mix master.
Bad,
huh? This is probably before she was socked in the eye by her boyfriend.
Wow. Amber kicking it provocative.
Nice. And the pop culture references.
Did Rihanna kick it? What'd you say? She hit him back? Oh, good for her. Anyway.
Okay, Amber, thank you for the research minute. Always learn something new, Andy.
That was good. And you know what? I'm kind of impressed with this new teacher project. They come up with this stuff, and then they did those other studies on hiring practices in urban districts. They're actually putting together some good work.
No, they do a great job. I mean, and they've got this nice hybrid model where, of course, mostly what they do is they do real stuff in the real world, like recruit teachers. And then they do the think tank stuff, too. Kind of makes us think tankers a little nervous. Although, actually, Fordham, we have a hybrid model also, because we do real things.
Authorized schools in Ohio.
That's right. Up on our blog right now, you can see pictures of some of the schools that Laura took and some profiles. Yeah. So, see, this is actually maybe Fordham and the new teacher project deserve to be in their own special category. Think tankers doing good.
Andy agrees.
Okay. Now it's time for us to rate that reform.
You still have to dance, Andy.
Yeah, I'm not down with this song as much.
I'm insulted.
Is this standard music for this segment, or do you alternate?
Yes, I now have an intro song.
I'm not going to criticize.
A little pep for the end of the podcast.
Andy, if you're going to be invited on the show regularly, you need to listen to the show.
I listen religiously. I just don't remember that tune.
Well, it's been there for a couple weeks now, at least.
All right. Maybe I'm behind.
All right, Stafford, what's happening out there in the...
Okay. Graduates of Oregon's many high schools are forsaking their top choice private universities for less expensive public options, reported the Oregonian last week. Hardly a newsworthy or unique situation. But what really caught my eye was the following caption under the accompanying picture. 13 of Cleveland's high school's 18 valedictorians from the class of 2009 are pictured. I'm sorry. 18 valedictorians? Excuse me. I kept reading. Turns out the paper surveyed 456 valedictorians from 97 high schools. That's an average of 4.7 valedictorians per school. Since the issue before us is not the subject of the article from which my information was gleaned, let me define the problem for you. It starts with the definition of valedictorian. Let's look it up. Random House Dictionary defines this term thusly. A student, usually the one ranking highest academically in the school graduating class, who delivers the valedictory at the commencement exercises. American Heritage Dictionary is even more precise. The student with the highest academic rank in a class who delivers the valedictory at graduation. Webster is short and sweet. The student who ranks first in scholarship. Bottom line, there is only one. I wouldn't say it's a huge deal that we bestow this honor on more than one graduating senior, though I bet if you're being so revoltingly politically correct about the title, they probably had 18 speeches at graduation too, which sounds like a long and boring ceremony. The problem really is that the grade inflation and weighting system behind the term. Obviously, if there are 18 kids with the title, then at the very least they all had straight A's and 4.0 GPAs. Even more likely, these high schools do crazy things like weight their AP and IB classes so that these students have GPAs higher than 4.0. With the right number of good grades and APs, you've got 4.2s, 4.5s, 4.7s. In some cases, these grading systems go up to 7.5. The reason that most of these schools do all this fancy numerical footwork is to help their seniors get into college. But the problem is that none of these numbers mean anything when the sky is the limit on GPAs. Furthermore, unless you're dealing with a high-quality college admissions officer, they probably don't know what your system means either, which just results in more confusion and probably the ignoring of grades altogether to the student's own detriment. I won't grade my own problem definition, but I will give execution on this one a D. This isn't a grave matter of life and death, like, say, the bus driver who stopped on the train tracks to scare his riders into being quiet, but it is still damaging.
Really good one.
Yeah. It was a really good one. Yeah. It is still damaging to the value of academic rigor and college admissions. Oh, and it's completely silly, too.
All right, so a couple things here, Stafford. All right, so, I mean, do we think that what's happening is that they've got 18 kids with 4.34 grade point averages?
I mean, that's ridiculous. You have to pick one. Create a system where it allows one student to be number one.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to rank your students at all, then you have to rank them. You can't just say, oh, well, pat on the head, I'm sorry. There are 18 of you now.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything anymore.
By the way, there's also, you know, I think we've talked about this before. I think many schools have delinked the top of the class from the speech. And for good reason, because let's face it. I mean, just because you got the highest GPA does not mean you can deliver a good speech at graduation.
It's true.
My brother, who's a high school teacher, told me about the phenomenon at his school, how this came about, that it was actually suburban parents who would come into the office and fight the principal and assistant principals about, well, my child had more AP classes. Yes, his GPA was lower, but he should be the valedictorian. So it inflated from 1 to 2 to 5 to 10 to 12. I think his final year there were 17 in his high school. Because of parents demanding of administration and administration not willing to fight back.
See, I think this is a little bit like the bowl championship series. I mean, isn't it? I mean, what we really need here, we get hung up on the statistics when really we just need to have an academic contest that winnows these valedictorians down to one. So I think that, you know, we could use the last couple weeks of senior year of high school, which isn't being used for much, and there could be a bunch of contest of the wits. And then at the end, you got your winner, one person.
Yeah. You've officially gone mad.
There it is. A bracket system.
No, I
like it. Why not an essay contest? I mean, it's not like seniors are doing anything after they get into college.
There's
got to
be some sort of contest that there's a clear winner or loser, and it's like a bracket. Because otherwise, there's too many. You can get into subjective. They're going to have the same problem again. They're going to give all the essays the highest score.
Right. See, I come down on state assessments when you're judging states and districts on how they're doing. In advance, you tell them how they're going to be evaluated. Then it's only fair at the end that you evaluate them that way. So that's why I trust New York State that they're doing the right thing. And in this way, if you tell kids they're going to be judged on GPA, whoever's highest 4 years later, they should be the valedictorian.
Well, Andy, then they should change the system, and there should be more things that go into it than GPA.
Trust. Trust but verify, my friend. Trust but verify. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thank you for joining us. Until next week.
I'm Andy Smerick.
And you said it right. And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, coming to you every week at edexcellence.net. Signing off.